lawyers in and bang the gavel.
The Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as this court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are conducting this oral argument by phone, and sometimes that creates some difficulty in understanding who is talking or who wants to ask a question. So I may intervene during the argument to bring things to a halt and make sure that everyone can hear what everybody else is saying. But with care, this has worked fairly well in our telephonic oral arguments, and I hope it will work well today. Our first case of the day is Jason against Saul. Mr. Paul.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Thomas Pullum for the Commissioner of Social Security. This case involved a challenge to administrative procedures used by the Social Security Administration in response to a massive scheme involving the use of fraudulent evidence.
Mr. Pullum, this is Judge Hamilton. Before we go any further, could we talk about a bit of a problem and also a potentially serious jurisdictional problem? Our Circuit Rule 30 requires the appellant to submit, bound with the main brief, an appendix containing the judgment or order under review. And I don't find the judgment in your appendix. And when I found the judgment, then it poses some problems.
Okay, I apologize for the oversight in putting it in not putting it in the appendix. I apologize.
Have you looked at the judgment recently?
No, I can't say recently that I have, but I will get it right now.
That would be a good idea, because it is at least confusing. Whether it's a final judgment, a proper final judgment, is open for debate.
Okay, hold on one second, please. I apologize. I'm sorry. It's going to take me a minute to find the judgment.
Well, perhaps you shouldn't take extra time. The problem is, beside the fact that this document is not where it's supposed to be, that the document is not self-contained. Let me read you part of it. And I quote, "Plaintiff's motion 24 is granted in part and denied in part. Defendant's motion 10 is granted in part and denied in part." What in the world does that mean? Judgments are supposed to provide the relief to which the prevailing party is entitled, and I can't figure out what the relief is because the judgment doesn't say.
Well, I believe the relief here was a remand to the Social Security Administration.
Think about the option about what it's to do. It could be remanded to award benefits. It could be remanded to consider Dr. Huffnagel's opinion. It could be remanded with instructions to the agency to consider argument on the question whether there is reason to believe that Huffnagel's opinion is tainted by fraud. It could be, well, I think you could fill in a long list of could-bes, but the judgment doesn't say which it is.
Well, I believe my understanding of the what the district court did here was hold that the Social Security Administration had not provided sufficient process to Mr. Jackson, and it ordered that...
Look, counsel, the judgment must be self-contained. You can't tell anything from looking at this document. But what does it mean, hasn't provided sufficient process? Does it mean that the agency must consider Dr. Huffnagel's opinion? Does it mean that the two statutes are declared unconstitutional? Does it mean that reconsideration is impossible or invalid? Yep. Judges, we need to know what's at stake here.
Well, I believe that what the district court did was say that the process that had been provided was insufficient, and the Social Security Administration needed to provide an opportunity for Mr. Jackson to contest adversarially the basis for the Inspector General's determination that there was reason to believe that fraud was involved in the submission of specific evidence.
What does that mean? Right? You're trying to interpret an opinion. We're trying to interpret a judgment. I don't even know what it means to say that more process is required. That has to be concrete. It's obvious that you're not thinking about this. Did anybody ask the district court to clarify and enter a proper judgment containing the relief?
I don't believe so, but the district court did say that it was reversing the secretary's decision and remanding for further proceedings. And so that was a remand under sentence 6 of 42 U.S.C. 405G, I believe. And that's a common judgment in Social Security cases, to reverse what happened below and remand for the Social Security Administration to do it again. So I believe that's what the district court required here.
Well, no, this judgment doesn't really fit with. Go ahead.
Yeah, counsel, judges require things in judgments. And this judgment is hopelessly ambiguous. It may be that the reason you omitted the judgment is that you think judges require things in opinions. Well, they don't. They require things in judgments. We've got a serious problem here that I think you're not appreciating.
I apologize. The omission of the judgment from the appendix was purely inadvertent.
The underlying problem, counsel, is that the judgment is hopelessly deficient. It is not something that wraps up the case. I have no idea what most of it means to say motion X is granted in part and denied in part. Period. Do you know what such a thing means?
Well, yes, it was a motion for judgment to reverse the commissioner's determination. So the district court has reversed the determination made before the Social Security Administration. That's my understanding. This is
what would you like us to do? The most sensible thing to do might be to dismiss the appeal for want of jurisdiction. Is that what you want us to do?
No, we would like, we're requesting that the this court reverse the district court.
Since we don't know what the district court is required and there is no proper judgment, wouldn't that be a little hard?
No, because the district court said it was sending... by granting the motion, it's sending the case back to the agency for additional proceedings. And we are asking
counsel to do which of the things that I mentioned? The district court three possibilities at least, and there could be more. And the judgment doesn't choose among them. You know, the standard way to fix problems like this is to ask the district court to enter a judgment fully resolving what the relief is and providing the remedy. Don't you think that would be a good idea here?
Well, I certainly if the court believes that is appropriate, I mean, that's something that could be done. But I believe this was similar to what happened in the Sixth Circuit, where the district court did not specify exactly what the agency had to do on remand, nor did the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit said that the Social Security Administration was required to provide additional process, an opportunity to test the basis for the inspector general's determination, and it sent the case back, leaving open to the agency in the first place exactly how to structure its procedures. So I think in this case is similar in that way, in that it left open to the agency how to correct the problem. It's not dictating to the agency exactly which procedure it has to adopt on remand.
While we're here, I tend to agree we've got a serious jurisdictional problem. We have extensive briefing on the merits. The jurisdictional problem may be fixable. Let's assume for the moment that it is. Could I ask you, Mr. Pullum, the statute, the key statute here, Section 405U, says if there is reason to believe that evidence is a product of fraud, without specifying who determines that or by what procedures. Do we have anything other than the so-called HALEX manual that tells us that that the OIG's referral based on fraud is final?
The HALEX is where these procedures are set out. The Social Security Administration has not promulgated regulations specific.
But to the extent that there's a constitutional problem, it's with HALEX, not with the statute. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that's correct. It's with the manner in which the agency has implemented the statute.
So I'd like you to imagine a hypothetical statute. Let's say it's a civil forfeiture statute, recognizing that, like the SSA's Office of Inspector General, the Drug Enforcement Agency is stuffed with capable investigators and lawyers. Suppose Congress passes a statute that says that if DEA finds reason to believe that property in the hands of a private individual amounted to proceeds of drug dealing, the property will be forfeited without any opportunity for that owner to dispute the DEA's finding. Would that pose a due process problem in your view?
Well, I think that's a very different statute because the DEA's determination that couldn't be challenged there would be the basis for the forfeiture. In other words, the property would be forfeited.
I don't really see the difference here because the critical factual finding in Mr. Jackson's redetermination proceeding was whether Dr. Hoffnagel's report was the product of fraud. I take it you would agree then that in my hypothetical there would be a huge due process problem.
I think there would be a due process problem there.
A problem that could not be avoided by Matthews versus Eldridge balancing and cost-benefit analysis. Because DEA is so reliable and there's really very little chance that the possessor of the money would be able to show that the DEA was wrong.
I think there's a couple different things going on here. One, Matthews would still apply. It's just that the balancing might well tilt in a different direction. I mean, this court has applied Matthews in cases where no hearing was provided at all. It's just that that would affect how the balance would shift. The case I'm talking about is Simpson versus Brown County.
Simpson, there was no hearing, right? And
there was no hearing, and the court still applied the Matthews balancing test. But I'd like to get at kind of the core of Your Honor's question, which was in the hypothetical, the property is forfeited on the based on the fact that DEA found. Here, the disability determination is not based on anything that the Inspector General found. The consequence of the Inspector General's determination was the exclusion of a small amount of evidence in the case.
That argument, I've got to say, is just completely disingenuous. I mean, I understand the government's outrage at the fraud by Khan and the doctors who worked with him and the ALJ. I understand that, believe me. As a taxpayer, I understand that. But to say this is no big deal in Mr. Jackson's case is ridiculous. It was the decisive evidence.
Well, with respect, the only reason that this evidence took on outsized importance was because it was part of the fraudulent scheme. I mean, under the scheme, Judge Daugherty would call Mr. Khan, tell him which cases he was going to hear and what type of evidence he needed, physical or medical. And then Khan would have one of his doctors sign this pre-completed form. That would be submitted to SSA, and benefits would be based solely on that without considering any other evidence in the record. So that's the only reason that this evidence was important.
Counsel,
I understand your point. We are all aware of the broad strokes of the fraudulent scheme here. And believe me, I'll have some questions, and my colleagues may also have some questions for plaintiff's side about just how he might intend to dispute the showing or the reason to believe that this was fraudulent. But to try to suggest that this is anything other than dispositive is asking us to just ignore reality.
Well, I don't think so. As the fact that over 50% of affected beneficiaries retained their benefits following redetermination, and I think that demonstrates that this evidence was
not a question of God. It's the question of how the evidence affects Mr. Jackson's case.
And so we look at, I think it's important to look at the procedural protections that are in place already and whether there's a serious risk of error caused by these procedures. There were two, as we explained in the brief, two procedural protections that are key here. Excuse me.
Mr. Pullman, it's Judge Scudder from the courtroom. I just want to make you aware, I know I didn't want to interrupt the colloquy you were having with Judge Hamilton, but I'm in the courtroom and watching the time, and you're over halfway into your rebuttal. Judge Easterbrook may choose to afford you additional time given the various questions that we had at the outset, but I just wanted to make you aware of where you're at on the clock.
Thank you very much. So I'll wrap this point up very quickly.
Counsel, this is really the court's time, and it's not a good use of your time just to recite what's already in your brief. I have a question about what you think is required in an ordinary Social Security case. Forget about redetermination. Suppose there is a dispute about the admissibility of a physician's report. How is that resolved? Would it be proper, for example, for the Social Security Administration to ask an ALJ to exclude the report and for the ALJ then to say, I am acting on the basis of that ex parte. I refuse to receive a response from the claimant in support of that evidence. Would that be proper as a matter of administrative law?
Well, I think it would depend on the Social Security Administration's basis. If it was based on a statute that requires the exclusion of evidence when certain conditions were met, and here those conditions were met.
Suppose the statute says we are going to exclude all evidence received from a doctor whose license has been suspended by the state regulatory agency. And the agency files a motion saying, we contend that X's license has been suspended. Please exclude this evidence. And the claimant says, we contend that X's license has not been suspended. And the ALJ says, I refuse to listen to you. I'm only going to listen to the commissioner's lawyers. Would that be proper as a matter of administrative law?
I think under due process principles, we would turn to the Matthews.
No, you don't. Look, I wish you'd listen to my question and answer what I'm asking. We never start with due process. You start with ordinary principles of administrative law. You get to due process if administrative law requires an outcome, and that outcome is said to be unconstitutional. I'm not asking a constitutional question. I'm asking a question about ordinary principles of administrative law. And that question is, can the ALJ grant an ex parte motion to exclude evidence?
I think, well, I don't think this qualifies as an ex parte motion to give effect to determination of another government entity that under statutory scheme.
Are you even considering answering my question? I am not asking about trying to shout down a court also doesn't help. I'm not asking about the administration of these statutes. I have asked you a hypothetical question about the exclusion of evidence on the basis that the physician's license has been suspended. What happens in such a case as a matter of ordinary administrative law principles?
I think most commonly that would be tested, but I'm not sure of any principle of administrative law, and I don't think the plaintiffs pointed to a general principle that dictates the outcome in this case or in the hypothetical that Your Honor is describing.
Are you seriously contending that it would be proper for an agency to refuse to listen to the claimant on the question whether the physician's license has been suspended? Just to refuse to listen to him at all?
I mean, I think in certain circumstances, like the circumstances we have here,
the circumstances we have here. That's why this is called a hypothetical.
Then, I mean, perhaps this hypothetical might be different because it's not built into the administrative scheme that governs the process. I am not trying to fight the hypothetical. I'm just not sure.
Judge Easterbrook, the time we're a few minutes into the rebuttal time at this point.
I'd like to save some time.
Perhaps you should save some time and think about where we are in this argument. Ms. Jennings.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. If it's all right with you, I'd like to proceed to address the merits on the assumption that you made while you were speaking with Mr. Pullum that the
no
defect here may be terrible, but okay.
Ms. Jennings, we need you
yes.
to talk about the judgment, too. Do you think this is a valid judgment?
So Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 58, which tells us that a judgment needs to be set out in a separate document. And this is, in fact, a separate document. And yes, it does, in fact, cross-reference the judge's opinion. But I do think the judge's opinion gives us some guidance as to what exactly the relief was that the judge intended to order.
Does the judgment say a word, for example, about reinstatement of benefits?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
Which seems like a kind of critical part of the relief that you thought you obtained. Has Mr. Jackson been getting benefits?
Yes, he has, Your Honor.
Okay. Whether that's by goodwill of the agency or, but it can't be by result of the judgment at this point.
I think it's indicative of the fact that the agency clearly interpreted this judgment as effectuating the writing in the opinion, whether or not it formally said all of the things that were in the opinion.
So what do you think are the answers to my questions about what the agency is supposed to do? Is it supposed to award benefits? Is it supposed to hold a brand new hearing? Is it supposed to offer him an opportunity to contest the reasonable cause finding?
And why did you cross appeal?
Yeah, so I can run through all of those. So the district court order says that the case should be remanded to the agency. On that, I agree with opposing counsel. It also says expressly that on remand, Jackson must be given the opportunity to challenge the basis for the commissioner's decision to extend Dr. Huffman's report.
Counsel, we are asking about the judgment, not about the opinion. I continue to be perplexed that lawyers don't understand the difference between judgments and opinions. The thing under review is the judgment, and we are asking whether the judgment provides any particular relief at all.
Then no, Your Honor, it does not provide the particular relief you're asking for. I apologize.
You, as a cross-appellant, have the same interest as the government, one would suppose, in having a judgment complying with not only Rule 58, but with the decisions of this circuit, saying judgments must be self-contained and must provide the relief to which the prevailing party is entitled. There is also Rule 58B2, which says that judgments must be reviewed by the judge and approved. There's no evidence that this document was anything other than something whipped up by a deputy clerk and never reviewed by a judge. Because it's impossible to see how, if this document were reviewed by a judge, it could have been approved.
Your Honor, all of that is on the face of this document. I'm not sure I have a response to that. I apologize for the oversight.
Why did you cross appeal? What relief do you want judgment did not give you?
So we cross-appealed because of our claims under the Administrative Procedure Act, specifically our claims that proceedings under Section 405U are...
No, please answer the question you were asked. The question you were asked is, what relief do you want that the judgment did not give you?
Well, I mean, Your Honor, you just said that if we're focusing on the judgment, the judgment does not say anything about our APA claims, which were the subject of our cross appeal.
Yeah, no,
my question is about relief, not theories, relief.
Yes, and the relief that we're seeking under our APA claim is distinct from the relief that we're seeking under our due process or our arbitrary and capricious claim. Because the requirements for formal adjudications under the APA are more robust.
So, counsel, please, what relief is that? Could you be concrete? What relief do you want that you think you do not have?
We wanted a remand to the agency with instructions to apply the formal adjudication provisions of the APA. And because those provisions differ from the specific provisions that were implicated by the others,
let me put this differently. One of the questions that was asked of your adversary concerned how ordinary evidence issues would be resolved in litigation. It doesn't really help to say the APA applies or the APA does not apply. If you're trying to resolve an issue about the admissibility of evidence, either before a court or before an agency, what concrete procedures do you think are required? Surely, I'm assuming you believe that in my hypothetical, it would be necessary to listen to the lawyer for the claimant about whether the doctor's license had been suspended. But do you think that requires a trial-type hearing as a matter of APA law?
No, Your Honor, I don't. And I don't think that's the consequence of applying the APA's formal adjudication of requirements here.
So what would applying the APA do concretely as you see it?
So, for example, if you look at Section 556E, that's the provision that says where an agency decision rests on official notice of a material fact not appearing in the record, you're entitled to an opportunity to show the contrary. In that situation, you would then be entitled to show that the purported fraud here did not in fact affect my client, Tyler Jackson's application for benefits.
That, of course, isn't the statute. That isn't the statutory question, as I understand it. But are you arguing for anything more than a right to submit an argument to the agency on the issue in question?
Well, again, very slightly, depending on which of our theories you're talking about. Under the APA, there's also a statutory provision that says you're entitled to such cross-examination as may be necessary for full and true disclosure of the facts, and that wouldn't necessarily be implicated by our other two theories. But that is fundamentally what we are asking for here.
So, Ms. Jennings, could I ask, what evidence does plaintiff have here to dispute the fraud, because obviously there are very powerful reasons here to discount anything Dr. Hoffnagel said. But if you get an opportunity to be heard on this question, what evidence would be provided?
The idea is that my client would be able to provide some testimony about what his visit to Dr. Hoffnagel was like, whether or not Dr. Hoffnagel provided him any medical advice or opined on his medical condition during that meeting. Perhaps he'd be able to track down some supportive testimony from someone who worked in Dr. Hoffnagel's office at the time, who could say that he came or she saw some of the tests. And I think it's also worth thinking about some of the nature of some of the evidence that was excluded in these cases. Although OIG's initial referral only referred to the residual functional capacity forms, which are those short checkbox forms, where the residual functional capacity forms.
Is any of that evidence that you're talking about, for example, testimony from Mr. Jackson or in the form of an affidavit or in hearing, is any of that in the record, or are we simply trying to decide here in the abstract whether there should be an opportunity to provide it in another hearing?
So, Your Honor, it's not in the record because we weren't permitted to develop this evidence before the agency. I think at least in terms of the due process clause, it's important to remember that the question of whether due process was provided is assessed on the basis of somebody who was erroneously denied benefits, not from the perspective of somebody who was properly denied.
Ms. Jennings, it's Judge Scudder. What your answer to Judge Hamilton's question, I want to flip the coin over and ask you, what do you think the scope is of your procedural due process right to get into the OIG investigation? you know, to ask questions about, you know, the basis upon which the Inspector General reached a conclusion, to view materials that the Inspector General relied upon, et cetera, et cetera.
What we're really talking about here is our ability to tell our side of the story as opposed to dig into what the Inspector General has done. That's the type of due process right that was found to exist in the Honda case, also in with Goss versus Lopez, where the students were expelled. And so what we're really talking about is the opportunity to tell our side of the story. Now, it is entirely possible that upon seeing our side of the story, the ALJ may not feel like it has enough information to make a determination, and the ALJ could then potentially call someone from OIG to provide further explanation, or it may be that OIG wishes to submit additional, more specific information about how they reached the broad determination in a particular case. But that, I don't think, is a necessary consequence of our due process argument here.
So you don't envision lodging on remand. You wouldn't envision lodging discovery requests, asking for a right to cross-examine, you know, a member of the Inspector General's office who made the findings or contributed to the findings and the like.
No, Your Honor, except to the extent that our formal adjudication argument is upheld, in which case, under Section 556D, we're entitled to such cross-examination as necessary for full and true disclosure of the record, and so we may consider that in that situation. And
Could I ask you quickly? There's an interesting background problem here about the relationship between the Social Security Act from the 1930s and the Administrative Procedure Act from, I believe, the late 1940s, if memory serves. In an ordinary Social Security disability hearing, what would happen under the Social Security Act if the ALJ called for testimony from a vocational expert and then refused the claimant's attorney's request to question that same expert?
So my understanding, and I don't have the specific SFA provision at hand to know this for certain, but my understanding is that that would be a basis to argue that the initial decision was flawed on appeal. An appeal
because,
to the appeals counsel.
Because of the denial of the right to cross-examine, that must have some source, either explicitly or implicitly, within the Social Security Act, right?
Yes, I believe that's correct. And I guess I'd just say a word in response to Judge Scudder's point about the nature of the relief we're seeking here, because I think that's important to keep in mind when you're thinking about how the three Matthews balancing factors come out here. We're talking about a private interest that even the commissioner has conceded is substantial. We're talking about a situation in which we know there's a real likelihood of erroneous determination. And we know that because if, for example, you look at the plaintiffs in the Hicks case in the Sixth Circuit, a number of those plaintiffs lost their benefits despite having passed continuing disability reviews, which are reviews SSA periodically undertakes to ensure that people are still suffering from the disability that initially justified their award of benefits. So notwithstanding the fact that those plaintiffs passed those CDRs, they still lost their benefits. So we know there is a risk of erroneous deprivation here. And then looking at the third Matthews factor, and this is, again, Judge Scudder, where your point comes in, is that the burdens of the additional procedure we're asking for here are not all that significant. When you think about the delta between the hearing that Jackson got and the hearing that Jackson wanted, we're really talking about the ability to put on some more evidence during that hearing, which may extend the length of a hearing that has already taken place.
Yeah, that's
place,
exactly.
But would not result in a parade of horribles.
Yeah, Ms. Jennings, that's exactly why I asked that question, because I'm curious what Mr. Pullman says. That's what I at least for my part, I want to ask him to address in his limited rebuttal time, but I just don't see a complete disaster unfolding on remand by allowing Mr. Jackson here to put forward evidence. You've proffered what form it may take, but I don't know why the ALJ wouldn't have broad discretion to prevent a fishing expedition. Doesn't sound like you want to go on one. And to demand that the claimant make an evidentiary-based showing, if he's able to, as to why the Inspector General's determination is in error as applied to him. It sounds like you agree with that.
Yes, I do, Your Honor. So, and then I think the other point that I think you all mentioned earlier is that the evidentiary exclusion here was, in fact, deposited in many cases. And part of the reason we know that is because of the nature of what's actually in the file before the agency in any one of these cases. So each of the redeterminations that went to a hearing because there wasn't enough evidence left in the file to show that the beneficiary was disabled after throwing out the evidence submitted by the cot-affiliated doctor. So in Jackson's case, the agency threw out, as I said, both the residual functional capacity form and the underlying report of Dr. Huffnagel's medical examination. And so at that point, the file contained a report of the consultative examiner retained by the agency, which generally concluded that the individual was not sufficiently disabled to qualify for benefits. And to counteract that report, you have to have your own medical evidence. I think you all appreciate that it's difficult, if not impossible, to retroactively develop medical evidence. That is particularly true here, where large swaths of medical evidence were destroyed by Khan or confiscated by federal investigators. But even setting that aside, it's just you can't go to a physician today and ask whether someone examined today was disabled 5 or 10 years ago. It's a complicated situation. And there's a key Seventh Circuit decision, actually, by Judge Flom that I think speaks specifically to the due process issue that's presented here, and that's the Kecmarchuk INS case.
Counsel, decisions of the court speak for the court. They are not opinions of Judge Flom. They're opinions of the Seventh Circuit.
Of course, Your Honor, I apologize for misspeaking. So if you look at Kecmarchuk versus INS, there the court held that the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment requires that petitioners, there they were immigration petitioners, be allowed an opportunity to rebut officially noticed facts, particularly when, as in this case, those facts are crucial to, indeed dispositive of, the outcome of the administrative proceeding. And I think that decision of the court is directly relevant here and because of the dispositive nature of the evidentiary exclusion that occurred before the agency.
Ms. Jennings, could you repeat the name or give us the citation of that case, please? I didn't hear it clearly because of the phone. Thank you.
Oh, yes, of course. So it's Kecmarchuk versus INS, and the citation for it is 933 F. 2nd, 588.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Jennings, you have a grand 40 seconds left. You want to make a...
Well, I think if the panel has no further questions for me, I will rest there. We request that you hold that the SSA's procedure violated due process and the APA's formal adjudication requirement. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Jennings. Anything further, Mr. Pullum? I will give you an extra 3 minutes.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to respond to a few points. There were some questions about what exactly Mr. Jackson would do with his additional procedures. In his brief, he specifically indicated that he pointed to the procedures that were suggested by Judge Sipar, which did involve cross-examination on the due process claim of an OIG agent. I think that could be extremely burdensome to do. And we have to balance that against the benefit of how this would mitigate the risk of error. And I don't think it would here. And I point the court to the Supreme Court's discussion of a similar issue in Cayley, where the court said, it pointed specifically to the standard that applied, which there was probable cause, which is roughly equivalent to our reason to believe here. And the court said, basically, we didn't think that this procedure would be useful in correcting erroneous deprivations because that standard is easy to meet, hard to displace, and can be reliably made without an adversary hearing, including having
when are probable cause determinations conclusive on the issue?
Well, they can have consequences. They're not conclusive on the deprivation.
Right, and that's why you might be able to suspend benefits, for example. But we're talking here about permanent termination and a conclusive resolution. So I don't see how that really helps you very much.
Well, because the reason to believe benefits weren't terminated on the basis of reason to believe. Benefits were terminated based on the overall case record and whether it established disability. And I'd like to point out that when Ms. Jennings spoke about kind of evidence that was available, Mr. Jackson had a considerable amount of evidence regarding his medical condition at the time. It included all of the records that SSA had developed during the early administrative procedures, two consultative examinations, x-rays taken at the time. So it wasn't as if Dr. Huffnagel's report were the only evidence that was available to him. There was quite a bit, over 100 pages of evidence of medical records in the file. And that's, putting aside all of the other evidence that he offered. So when we're talking about kind of what was available to base a decision on, there was quite a bit that was already there. The SSA procedures are designed to, and they're required to, develop a complete medical history of the applicant's condition at the time of the application, and that was done in this case, as in all cases. So I think just because there's no reason to believe that ultimately the goal here is to get in evidence that was signed by someone who had been implicated in a fraud, submitted by a doctor by an attorney who's been convicted of a fraud. There's no reason to believe that submitting this evidence will make the proceedings any more accurate. Indeed, they may undermine confidence in these procedures, which is an important government interest because of the size and burden that this program imposes on all taxpayers. Everyone has to contribute to Social Security.
Mr. Pullman, thank you. Your time, you're about a minute over your time, so thank you.
Thank you very much. We ask that the district court judgment be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. The court will put this appeal on hold for 14 days to give the parties time to go back to the district court and ask it to enter a self-contained judgment providing the relief to which the prevailing party is entitled. Once that has been done, parties should provide this court with the revised judgment together with statements about how they believe those changes affect the pending proceedings in this court. Okay? Let us see if we can get this fixed.
Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. When that is received, the case will be taken under advisement.